Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
And in his very first match, he scores a try, and you get his fucking name wrong.
Hi all, it is episode 52 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. So this week's guest is Paul Howard, probably best known as the man behind Ross O'Carroll Kelly, but before he was using sport to lampoon the world, Paul's world was sport. He was a sports writer with the Sunday Tribune, as, in fairness, most of you will know, given only Hugh McIlvany's work has been cited more often by guests on this podcast so far. So we're going to get to the conversation with Paul in just a moment. But before that, the weekly reminder to get in touch with us, email behindthelines@the42.ie. You tweet me, I'm @gcooney93. And if you do want to join the conversation with like-minded fans of this show, where you can swap reading recommendations for the week or submit future questions for guests and so forth, then join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of the podcast. And if you do want the PDF doc of all of our guests' reading picks thus far, we've now got 52 episodes, so it's a hell of a reading list. Just get in touch. I've compiled it and I'll send it on to you. But now, on with our conversation with Paul Howard. Okay, Paul, so we're now at 1.5 million Ross books, 4 Ross stage plays, 2 musicals about Ireland's most notable dens of iniquity, Coppers and Anglo-Irish Bank. We've had 4 Irish Book Awards, 1 autobiography about Roy Keane's dog. I assume you regret your decision to leave sports writing every day?
I never really wanted to leave, you know. And it still breaks my heart that I did. I suppose I kind of had to, really, because, you know, Ross was sort of becoming really, really successful around the mid-1990s, and I was kind of a bit tired at that stage of the day job, of what I was doing, and this opportunity presented itself to become a full-time author, and I didn't know how many more Ross books there would be. I suspected probably 2. I've done 15 since then, but it really started as a 2-year sabbatical from the Sunday Tribune, and that's you know, it came at a time really when I kind of felt like I needed a break. But I never really wanted, I never in my life ever wanted to be a novelist. I never ever wanted to write books really of any kind. But it just sort of happened. And like, never mind musicals, like that was kind of never on my career plan. But pretty much everything that's happened to me professionally since I left journalism has just been a complete accident.
I was wondering, did you leave sports writing out of becoming jaded with it? But it sounds like it was less that than just a time pressure thing.
No, there was time pressure thing, and then Penguin, who were publishing me, had said, you know, we'd like you to go full time for a couple of years, and I kind of knew I had to do that. The pressure of writing a book a year on top of a job as I was then the chief sports writer for the Sunday Tribune, it was huge. And I was writing the books at weekends and evenings. I was taking, you know, 2 or 3 weeks holidays at a time to write a book. And I took one of the Ross books, I had about half of it written, and I took it with me to the Olympics in Athens in 2004. And it's a long day when you're covering an Olympics, like you're always on, you know. And I was probably working maybe 15 hours a day between writing and going to events and traveling. I was doing about 15 hours a day, and then I was going back to the Olympic Village at night and doing 4 hours of Ross, because I had a book to finish. So I was sleeping for about 3 hours a night. And that was in 2004. And I knew I couldn't keep that up. Like I was really exhausted. But I think around that time as well, I was becoming a little bit disillusioned with the job. And with especially how it had changed over the course of, of about sort of 5 years. the opportunity to interview people in particular was, you know, that it was kind of that was kind of coming to an end, you know, access. You were no longer getting access. So you'd ring a footballer, and if you managed to get their phone number, their mobile number, they would say, talk to my agent. Or, you know, you'd bring a GA player and you'd get, oh, I didn't talk before the last match, so I'm not going to talk before this match. Because it was good luck for me not talking. And then, you know, you could, like rugby, I did some rugby writing, and the same thing, the players were being roped off. And in situations where, you know, where the interview wasn't arranged with a sponsor, say, and, you know, you had to mention some energy drink in the intro, and then in six subsequent times in a piece, like that was, those kind of rules were being put on interviews. But when they were through the IRFU, it was this thing of, you know, you got to ask four questions and then there's a PR flunky telling you to wrap up, mm-hmm. you know, wrap up the interview. So it was changing a lot. The access was disappearing. And I think I was becoming quite disillusioned with sport as well, especially that 2004 Olympics, where I just didn't really believe anything of what I was seeing.
Literally nothing.
Nothing. No. I mean, I remember going into that Olympics, there was a drug scandal coming into it, and there's a drug scandal going out of it. And Cathal Lombard tested positive for EPO just before the Olympics. And I remember covering that, writing that story in the week before the Olympics. And then Ireland won a gold medal at the Olympics, and it was Keane O'Connor on his horse Waterford Crystal. And then a few weeks later, I remember it was in Paris. Ireland were playing against France in Paris in football. And we found out the night before the match, it was a Friday night, that the horse had returned a positive drug test. And I remember me and Malachy Clerken, who were both in Paris to cover the match. I remember the two of us in this tiny little hotel room just off the Champs-Élysées, sitting down to write the story at 10 o'clock at night. And we knew we were going to the stadium the next day, you know, to cover the game. So we basically stayed up all night. You know, relatively early days for the internet. This was sort of 2004. So there wasn't a huge amount of material about you know, about equine doping, whether accidental or intentional, on the internet. And I remember the two of us trying to put this story together, ringing people at like midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and apologizing profusely for disturbing their sleep. But can you answer these questions for us? But writing about doping had become such a huge part of my job. I brought a stack of books to the Olympics in Athens. And, you know, I probably had 30 books with me, and I think 25 of them were about drugs, you know, and I could pronounce chemical compounds that were nine syllables long without even stumbling over the word. Like, so it had become so much a part of what I did. And then I kind of began to suspect something that has subsequently proven completely true, which was that doping in sport was essentially about to be legalized. And I think now it has. You know, I watch sport now and I don't get as upset about doping as I used to, because, you know, with the TUEs, you know, you can essentially use whatever you want as long as you have a note. So they've kind of legalized it now. So even more so, I don't believe what I see anymore. But because I don't write about sport for a living, I don't get as upset about it. Like, I stopped watching certain events. Like, I didn't watch anything of the last Olympics. Nothing. And I was mad about the Olympics. My whole life, I just wanted to cover the Olympics. That's probably, one of the main reasons I wanted to be a sports writer. And I didn't watch anything of the Olympics. And I watched very, very little of the one before that.
Mm. And do you think, had you never been a sports writer, would you still be able to watch the Olympics today?
No, I don't think so. I, like, you know, I watched the 100 meters and it's just grotesque to me. You know, I don't see that as a sporting contest. I just, a lot of those events, that to me, they're just pharmaceutical contests. You know, they're nothing, they don't have anything to do with sport.
Mm. There were happier times at the Tribune, I'm sure. What memories stick out?
There were. Sorry, I'm making it sound like I hated every day of it. But this was kind of, this really was the last 2 years, I'd say, when that creeping disillusionment came in, and the offer to go and write books for a couple of years came at just the right time, because I thought it is time to stay. Because I've been a sports journalist from the time I was, 17. Almost pretty much from the time I left school, I was a journalist. I never went to college or anything, so I went straight into it. And I was definitely ready for a break at that stage.
Mm. Malachy Clerkin, in the very first episode of this podcast, said that you worked so hard at the Tribune, you literally gave yourself a hernia. Is this true?
It wasn't one of those hernias. It wasn't the groin hernia. I had a hiatus hernia. I have kind of stomach issues and always have. How to explain it in lay terms. Your stomach has a muscle at the top, kind of like a sphincter that keeps your stomach closed and food falls down and it opens and allows it in. Well, I don't have that muscle. So anything I eat, it swirls around and I get a lot of acid reflux and stuff like that, and it's particularly bad if I'm stressed. And in that period that Malachy's talking about, it would have been around 1999. And I was the sports editor of the Tribune for a year and I hated it. Like I really, really hated the job because it was just so far from what I wanted to do, which was write. And the stress was very, very, I mean, I probably took it a lot more seriously than I needed to. But I stressed myself into having this, severe stomach problems, and I had this operation to try to fix this issue with the bottom of my esophagus going into my stomach, and they tied a bit of gut around the end of my esophagus to try and create a muscle. But anyway, the upshot of this, the legacy for me, is a scar that runs from, my waist right up to just below my sternum. And that's my, my war wound. That's the scar that being a sports editor left on me.
It is good to tick the boxes of the illegitimacy of sport and acid reflux to get those boxes ticked and out of the way earlier on. Come here, we've had your pieces have been your second in the table across. So we've had, this is what, episode 52. We've had guests pick three or four pieces across them all. You're second only to Hugh McIlvany in the table in terms of most.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, so it's very graceful of you actually to pick a Hugh McIlvany piece for us later on, but we'll get to it in a moment. But one of the pieces that's been picked of yours was the Raul Nazario one, where the referee who hurt Ireland, shall we say, in a World Cup playoff against Belgium, I think it was. You went and you interviewed him. He turned out to be a character. Will we call him that? Can you tell us maybe just a little bit about the background of the story?
Raul Nazario was a name from my childhood, like a kind of villainous name from my childhood, along with, Darth Vader, and he loomed that large in my imagination, because he stopped Ireland going to the 1982 World Cup finals, and it was a brilliant Ireland team. If you remember, the team with Brady, Stapleton, O'Leary, Highway, they were a really amazing team, and they were drawn in this group of death. People talk about groups of death now. They've got nothing on this one. Like, Ireland were the fourth best team in the group. And they had France, Belgium, and Holland. And Holland had been World Cup finalists the two previous World Cups. Belgium, who beat Argentina in the first match of the 1982 World Cup. And France, who finished, who reached the semi-finals of the 82 World Cup and then won the European Championships. So it was a really top class group. And Ireland were in a position where if they had got a draw against Belgium in Brussels, they would have gone to the World Cup. And the match turned on two pieces of ill luck that Owen Hand said weren't ill luck at all. He said to the Raul Nazari, who was the referee, "You've robbed us." Walked right up to him and said, "You've robbed us." And the two decisions were, there was a Stapledon goal disallowed. It was never clear why it was disallowed. And there was a free kick on the edge of the box in the final couple of minutes that Belgium scored from. And the free kick was never a free kick. It was, you know, it was a complete ready up. So anyway, I just had this idea one day that I would try and find Raul Nazari and see would he talk to me. And I found him quite easily. I rang because he'd retired a long time, and he had been a trade union official in Portugal. So he's quite well known. He was certainly very accessible to the media. And I phoned a journalist in a newspaper in Lisbon and asked if he knew where I could get him. And he said, "Hang on, I'll give you his number." So I phoned him up and I said, "I'd love to interview you." And he said, "Oh, I would love that." And weirdly, in his head, I think because he did Ireland down, because he screwed Ireland over, I think he kind of had a sort of affection for Ireland. And I think he kind of did it because he kind of felt he owed an explanation or something. So anyway, I called to Owen Hand's house. Owen Hand was living in Rathmines. And it was the night before. And I just called into him and knocked on his door. And I said, I'm going to interview Raul Nazari tomorrow. And he said, "You're fucking joking me." I said, no. He said, "And he's going to let you interview him." And I said, "Yeah." He said, come in. "I'll get you the tape." And I said, "What?" He said, "I have the tape of the match." And it was, he had it under the telly. And I, like, this was kind of 2002. So it's 21 years after this match. And Owen still had the VHS cassette of this tape on the TV stand. So he gave it to me. And he said, "Make him watch it. That's what you got to do. You got to make him watch it." So I went to Portugal and I met him. And we had lunch. And then I said to him, "I'd love to watch the match." And he said, "Oh yeah, let's go to my apartment and we'll watch the match." So we go to the apartment and we put the tape on, and we're joined in the living room by his daughter and his son-in-law. And so the four of us are sitting watching this match. Oh, and a translator. I had a translator with me. So five of us are watching this match. And we watch the two incidents. And the first one is the disallowed goal. And I asked him, "Why did you disallow the goal?" And he said, "I remember so clearly, Frank Stapleton was offside." So when I play the incident, it's just quite clear that Frank Stapleton isn't offside. He isn't even nearly offside. He's well on, he's a good meter and a half onside. And I watched his face and I was kind of, I was ready for his reaction because I had watched it. So I knew what was going to be on the screen and I just wanted to see his reaction. And I just watched him grow pale when he saw it, because this lie he had told himself for years and years was being pulled apart in front of him. So he came up with several other excuses for disallowing it. Then he said, "Oh, I remember clearly now, it was it's supposed to be an indirect free kick and the ball goes in directly from the free kick." And I said, "But it doesn't, Frank Stapleton kicks it." And he said, "No, it just looks like he kicks it." And there was this hilarious bit where his daughter kept undermining him. She kept saying, no, this Frank Stapleton, man, he kicks this ball. So she's kind of undermining him, not knowing why.
And is the son-in-law rowing in support of Raul Nazari? Like he should be.
Yeah, the son-in-law, it turns out, this is kind of what he did for a living. He sold slow motion video technology to TV companies, right? So he presents his card to me and says, "Well, look, I know what I'm talking about here. And my father-in-law is right. It doesn't, Frank Stapleton doesn't touch it." And I said, "But they changed his direction." They finally accepted that the Frank Stapleton did kick it. And then he had a third excuse, which I think he said hit him. It hit the ref. It hit Raul Nazari, which it didn't. And And then we did something similar with the other incident. And essentially he couldn't explain it. He just couldn't explain it. But I really, really rattled him. He was just, it was almost like some ghost had come back from his past and he's had to face this thing. This I mean, he'd clearly been telling himself lies for all these years, you know? But I remember the final, if this is a movie, the final reel of this story is we're in the car and we're driving away and the woman who interpreted the interview for me, she's driving and she looked in the rearview mirror and she said, look back, look over your shoulder. And I look back and Raul Nazare is standing in the middle of the road and he's blowing an imaginary whistle and he's proffering an imaginary red card to send me off. It was a really bizarre end to probably the most bizarre interview I've ever done.
Any word from him since?
No, nothing. Nothing at all since. No. There was no kind of. I mean, I'm sure they didn't get the Sunday Tribune in Lisbon. You know, I did send him a copy, but I never heard anything afterwards. You know, but Owen Hahn did say to me, it kind of made everything about the story made sense to him after yeah. I told him about Nazare's ham-fisted ways of attempts to explain what had happened.
Yeah, Owen recounts it in his book, actually. He brought it in an autobiography a couple of years ago and talks about your interview with Raul Nazare.
Yeah, yeah.
And like when you're haunting Raul Nazare with his ghost from his past, as you describe it, are you feeling a little bit of guilt or is it just righteous vindication on behalf of your country?
No, neither of those things. I definitely didn't feel I was right or wrong on behalf of the country. I mean, I did think it was a terrible injustice that Ireland never got to play in that World Cup. Northern Ireland qualified for that World Cup, by the way, with fewer points than the Republic went out on. And it was just the manner of it. And it was one of about kind of four decisions in the 70s and 80s that stopped Ireland qualifying for major tournaments. And I would have been of the view that this wasn't a coincidence, that there were conspiracies to keep, if not keep small teams out of World Cups and European Championships, to keep big teams in, to ensure that the countries that, you know, punched their weight commercially were in those tournaments. And certainly that period of history, where you're talking about Belgium in particular, and, you know, there was a lot of corruption about the place. Referees were paid off. In that period, that same period, the early 80s, Anderlecht bribed their way to the semi-finals of the UEFA Cup, you know, and that, you know, that was established as a fact. I don't know if there's a truth about that Ireland-Belgium match to come out one day, but I certainly don't think Raul Nazare's explanations for what happened held any water at all. And I didn't feel remotely guilty about it. You know, you don't in that moment. It's a story. As that scene is unfolding in the living room, I've got such a visual memory of it, like, you know, of all everything that happened in that room, like, you know. And I remember the son, he used his son and daughter and son-in-law and daughter as pieces, like on a chessboard, to represent Stapleton and Brady. And he's saying, now you stand there and you stand there. And this whole thing played out over the course of about 4 hours in this man's living room. So all I'm thinking, I'm not feeling guilty at all. I'm just thinking, yeah, this is an amazing story. Like, the stories like this just don't come along every day.
We'll stick with Irish football for the first year picks, Paul. It's about a striker called Paddy Moore, written by Sean Ryan, and it was included in the essay in the book. It's an essay, sorry, in the book of Irish goalscorers. I wasn't able to find this piece, so you'll have to talk me through it or talk me through who Paddy Moore is.
Yeah, this piece, as far as I know, Sean Ryan won the AT Cross Sports Writer of the Year award sometime in the 1980s for this piece. And there's an extended version of it. It's a sort of essay that appears in the Book of Irish Goal Scorers. And that's what that's the piece I reread today before I was going to talk about Paddy Moore. But Paddy Moore was, if you're to believe the stories, was the kind of George Best of his generation. Billy Behan, the Man United scout, said for 2 years of his career, he was the best Irish player he'd ever seen. And he played most of his career in the League of Ireland, as it happens, went to Cardiff for a season and didn't settle, came back because he was homesick, played for Aberdeen for, I think, a couple of seasons in Aberdeen, and that didn't work out either. But he was essentially finished at 24, 25 years of age, like George Best. I mean, that's why the comparisons with George Best are just so tempting, because they're both essentially washed up at the same age due to the same problem, which was alcoholism. But Paddy Moore was an alcoholic in the 1930s, at a time when it was treated as Sean says in his piece, it was treated as a personality defect rather than a medical condition. So he never got help for it. And he successfully hid it for a lot of his career. But as Sean says in his piece, there's all sorts of hints about, you know, missing matches, being sent home from various tours for, you know, unexplained reasons. With a piece like this, I'm always drawn to stories like this about players who could have been, you know, and there's something really kind of interesting about players who don't fulfill their potential due to some flaw in their makeup, because I think it makes the players, like mentally strong players, seem even more godlike. You know, players who can withstand the pressure just seem more godlike when you read about somebody like Paddy Moore. The George Best thing, I bought this book recently, The Story of Charlie Gallagher, the GAA's Lost Icon, and I bought it because I picked up the book and I saw on the back that he was the George Best of Gaelic football in the swinging 60s, and immediately I say, I need to, there's something about those kind of stories that I just love. And what I knew about Paddy Moore when I read Sean's piece for the first time, the only thing I knew about Paddy Moore was that he scored 4 goals for Ireland in a match against Belgium. And it was a World Cup qualifier in 1934. And he was just, you know, by far and away the best player on the pitch. And he scored 4 goals. He was 5'5" tall. He was a small guy, stocky, like overweight, actually. Scored with his head, like, you know, got the equalizer in the last minute with a header at 5'5", you know. So there's all these stories about them. What about Paddy Moore? What's great about Sean Ryan's piece is it's just so brilliantly researched. There's such a dearth of good documentary footage of football, but not just football, any sport around those times, because, you know, modern sports writing is essentially a modern thing, you know, like it didn't really exist until, you know, maybe it's, in Ireland, it didn't really exist until the 70s, you know. And if you go back and read, as I often do, you go back and read news, you know, sports reports from the 30s or 40s or 50s, it's kind of like reading the financial pages now, you know. It's very dry language. It's kind of, sometimes it can be quite flowery. A bit, you know, there's a bit of purple prose here and there as well. But it's all that kind of, you know, we would expect Ireland to show, you know, the esprit de corps we expect from them, this stuff, that kind of stuff, you know, that's what sports journalism was at the time. So for Sean Ryan to actually get to be able to piece together the story of Paddy Moore's life and times with such, you know, with such a thin availability of, you know, archival material, I suppose. But he did it it's that kind of old fashioned pavement pounding reportage. You know, he went and found people who knew him, who would have been, you know, quite advanced in their dotage, I would say, at that stage. Like when Sean wrote this piece, it was kind of 50 years after Paddy Moore died. So there weren't a huge number of people around who would have played with him, but he found players who played with him. He found players who people who watched him. And there's this really heartbreaking interview he did with his widow. And he got married very late in life. And it was during the war, he met a woman when the North Strand was bombed. He was from Ballybock, just near Croke Park. And when the North Strand was bombed, he was repairing a wall for a woman, and he met her while he was repairing the wall, and they fell in love, and they went to England, and he kicked alcohol when he went to England and got fit and lost weight, and his football career was over at this stage, you know, because he had bad injuries as well as the alcoholism hampering him. But he came home to Dublin for his father's funeral, and he never went back again. And she said that's essentially what killed him, that he came back to Dublin and fell into his old habits, and she moved back with him. They didn't have a house, so she was living in her parents' house and he was living in his parents' house, and he was dead within 2 years. Like, he was just 41 when he died. But that's the thing that just underlines the tragedy, is that, you know, the way he's spoken about in Sean's piece, you know, like, it's easy to say somebody was, he could have been the George Best of his time, or, you know, it could have been the Pele of his time, but he is spoken about in the same breath as Puskas, Pele, you know, Dixie Dean. He was contemporary to Dixie Deans and was often compared to him as well, you know.
And not dissimilar to George Best, he also did play for Northern Ireland, because he was one of those, he was playing in that strange time when the FAI and the IFA in the North claimed to be the Football Association for the whole island. So he did technically play for the two teams.
Yeah, so he played for what they used to call the Free State, and then he played for the IFA, which is now Northern Ireland. But there weren't a lot of internationals around at the time. I mean, Paddy Moore only won 10 caps. That's the extraordinary thing. I think he scored 7 goals and only won 10 caps. But 2 years could go by and Ireland would play a match, you know? Yeah. And the World Cup was only new then as well. You know, it wasn't... Nobody, I think a lot of people didn't think it was going to catch on even, you know, it was kind of, it was really trying it out at that stage, you know, it wasn't the tournament it became, but amazing story, you know, and Sean just did such a beautiful job pulling it together, pulling all those strands together and doing the interviews. It's really a great piece.
You mentioned how dry the copy could be in sports writing back in the day. I would imagine one of the people foremost in changing it was Hugh McIlvany, who is the author of your second piece that you've picked for us today, which is Johnny Owen's Last Fight.
Yeah, I mean, Hugh McIlvany is just my favorite sports writer really of all time, you know, and I have his books on boxing and I have his book on boxing and his book on football. But this particular book here, it's called Reading the Fights. I bought it probably 30 years ago. And as you can see, it's well thumbed and the edges are all frayed and everything. That's just down to how often I've read it. And his piece on Johnny Owens, is one of the most extraordinary pieces of sports writing I've ever read. And Johnny Owens, for those who don't know him, was a Welsh boxer from Merthyr Tydfil. And he fought for the WBC bantamweight title in Los Angeles in 1980 and died as a result of injuries he sustained in the ring against Lupe. It's a beautiful piece of writing. What's interesting about it in this particular book, it's called Reading the Fights. It's a compilation of great boxing writing, and they juxtapose two pieces together. They have, first of all, Hugh McIlvany's profile of Johnny Owens, which appeared before the fight, and it's called Onward, Virgin Soldier. And then immediately afterwards, they have what's essentially his obituary for Johnny Owens. And to read the two of them together, it makes it even more heartbreaking. Just to give you an example of the writing, like, you know, he's saying here, you know, making some notes about the background to the fight on Friday morning, I found myself writing, feel physical sickness at the thought of what might happen, the fear that this story might take us to a hospital room. The scribble was not meant to imply any severe criticism of a match, which on the basis of the relevant statistics could not be condemned as outrageous. Indeed, the apprehension might have been illogically excessive to anyone who set Pinter's career figures of 41 wins, 7 losses and a draw against the fact that Owen's one defeat came in a blatant case of larceny. But then he says here, hang on a second. Yeah, at the end, he's talking, there's a fantastic piece in the original profile he wrote the week before the fight, where he talks about his mother and you know, and he writes about this like it's a family tragedy. It's not a sports story. This is a family tragedy. And he talks, there's this fantastic vignette in it where his mother refused to watch her son fight ever. Mm. And she'd never, ever seen him fight. And what she would do is she would go, they didn't have a phone in the house, but when he fought, she would go to the phone box at the top of a hill in Merthyr Tydfil, and she would wait in the phone box for the phone to ring. And it was the local sports reporter who would tell her whether her son had won or lost. And this was a ritual that she observed for every single fight. And there's this moment here in this piece. Yeah, it said, I had sat by the swimming pool at their motel in downtown Los Angeles and listened to them joke about the calls Johnny's mother had been making from Merthyr Tydfil on the telephone they had recently had installed. The call was made to Mrs. Owen from the waiting room of the California hospital shortly before 7 a.m. on Saturday, Merthyr Tydfil time, 11 p.m. on Friday, Los Angeles, and had a painfully dreadful tone. It was made by Byron Board, a publican and close friend of the family. He found her already in tears because she had heard that Johnny had been knocked out. The nightmare that had been threatening her for years had become a reality. And it's just that image of her waiting by the phone as she had done for every fight. And then she gets the call that she's dreaded all her life. Just, it's really heartbreaking. And Hugh McIlvany, he wrote in such a sparse way, like, you know, in some ways that there's not a word wasted, like, you know, there's not an excessive word in anything he writes, as far as I can see. But you could give him the same 12 words as the rest of us, and he could do something extraordinary, more extraordinary than we could even dream of doing with those 12 words, you know. And that was Hugh McIlvany's skill. And as well as his understanding of sport, it was like music to him. You know, when I read these passages, you know, it's just like hearing music. And I think he had that tune in his head. There's a rhythm to his writing. He was a freak in so many ways.
Mm, it's the closing lines of the. What ultimately became his obituary, really, as you described it, is what will always stand out to me. Our reactions are bound to be complicated by the knowledge that it was boxing that gave Johnny Owen his one positive means for self-expression. Outside the ring, he was an inaudible and almost invisible personality. Inside, he became positive and astonishingly self-assured. He seemed to be more at home there than anywhere else. It is his tragedy that he found himself articulate in such a dangerous language.
It's really stunning piece of writing. And even just before that as well, Gavin, he says, he actually voices something that I would have shared during my career, which was doubts about boxing as a sport. And it was always my favorite sport. It was always my favorite sport to write about. It was my favorite sport to watch. But he says here, you know, she can scarcely, talking about Johnny Owen's mother, she can scarcely avoid being bitter against boxing now, and many who have not suffered such personal agony because of the hardest of sports will be asking once again if the game is worth the candle. And that's an amazing thing for Hugh McIlvany to admit, that this, you know, this is a man who wrote so eloquently about boxing, you know, and, you know, was almost born for Muhammad Ali in the same way that, you know, Hunter S. Thompson was born for Richard Nixon. You know, there's a writer who's born for a moment in time or for a person in time. And McIlvany and Norman Mailer were, you know, I could believe they were born for Muhammad Ali to reflect the greatness of this man. So because, you know, McIlvany had written so beautifully and so well about boxing, for him to admit in this piece that he had doubts about whether it was a legitimate sport or whether it should be banned was, you know, it's quite an extraordinary thing for him to write.
Have you vivid memories of being ringside somewhere where you've had those thoughts that this is barbarism?
Yeah, and it is usually when you're ringside, you know. I remember being at one of Wayne McCullough's fights. I can't remember which fight it was, but like most of McCullough's fights, once he kind of reached the world title level, it was brutal, you know, because Wayne never knew when he was beaten. So all of his fights tended to be wars. But I remember going home from one fight covered in his blood. Like, it was all my face and glasses and on my shirt and everything, you know? And yeah, there's times like that you think, you know, it's not like coming home from a football match, you know, this is very, very different. I never saw anything, you know. I saw men knocked out, you know. I think I saw Paul Hodkinson knocked out and he was essentially out before his head hit the boards, you know, and that's a shocking thing to watch. It really is, like, to see the violence of that. And I think it was as I got older, I think that is a natural thing about aging. You start to value life more because you start to think more about your own mortality, and that's just what it is to become middle-aged. And I find it really difficult to watch boxing now. I find it impossible to watch, you know, UFC, that stuff. I can't bear it, you know. It's the violence just seems pornographic to me, you know. But I have fond memories of covering, you know, I covered Steve Collins's career and I covered Dave McCauley's career, and those were some of my happiest days as a sports writer.
You mentioned that Norman Mailer and Hugh McIlvany were the perfect writers for Ali. Interestingly, you've picked an Ali piece next, but it's by neither of those. It's by Gary Smith for Sports Illustrated, called Ali and His Entourage. I had never read this before. It is absolutely amazing. Yeah, tell us a little bit about it.
I mean, it's probably 12,000, 13,000 words long. And like a lot of great sports journalism, it's actually the idea. It starts with the idea. And it's actually not an interview with Muhammad Ali. It's an interview with his entourage today being 1988. And it appeared in Sports Illustrated. And he interviews, essentially there was a comet trail that followed Ali everywhere he went. And it consisted of, you know, his doctor, his logistics man, his cook, his masseur, his bodyguard, his manager, his motivator. And Gary Smith set out to find all of them, to find out what they, you know, what life was like for them now. These Where Are They Now pieces are, you know, they're hit or miss, because sometimes the story's really dull. And as it happens with this one, it was the opposite, because what's interesting about this kind of comet trail that followed Ali, everything in their lives, when you read this story, you realize that everything that happened in their lives after their involvement with Ali feels like postscript, because they traveled the world with this man, the most, you know, the greatest athlete of all time, the most charismatic athlete of all time, who almost seemed to be born for a moment in time. He was the man for the 60s, you know, his stand on Vietnam, on African-American rights, civil rights. Everything about Ali was perfect. It was of the moment. And to be part of that entourage was to be, you know, to just have a privileged, have a sort of privileged view of a moment in time and when the world was changing. They met presidents. They, you know, had dinner with kings. They traveled the world, every continent with Ali. And then they all settled down to very, very normal, mostly humdrum lives, you know, and that's the kind of sadness of this piece. So, I mean, some of them, they coped, I think, some coped better than others, but there was an adjustment to be made, you know. It's like you've got the most exciting life in the world, and then you have to carve out your own identity independent of Muhammad Ali's. Mm. And, you know, there's sort of seven or eight, actually, interviews here. And the one, he saves the best till last. And Bundini Brown was Muhammad Ali's kind of vibe master, really. You know, he wrote a lot of the poetry that Muhammad Ali used to spout, like, you know, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. That was Bundini Brown. He was kind of a rapper, really, before his time. You know, he used to write this kind of street poetry, really. And he was Ali's vibe master. He used to just make Ali feel good about himself. He didn't really have any other role. He might have had some kind of functionary role as well. He might have been a fixer or something like that. But he was essentially Muhammad Ali's mouthpiece. And he was the one that didn't cope at all with the transition to a normal life afterwards. And it's really tragic. There's a moment in it where he's talking about how he's essentially living in one room, and he has all of these, it says he has Ali's robes from every fight he ever fought, every pair of trunks we fought in, lots of jock straps too, enough stuff to fill a museum. But it's all in a kind of lockup storage place. And he owes the place $9,000. Now, can you imagine what this stuff is worth? Ali's robes, Ali's shorts. The lot would probably fetch 25 million at auction or something today. But he owes this place $9,000. So he can't get the stuff out. And there's a tragedy in that, just a circular tragedy that he has this enormous wealth, but it's just beyond his fingertips and he can't get at it, you know? But then the postscript to this story is that it's in italics at the bottom. It says a few days later, this is after he leaves. Throughout the interview, Bundini Brown is begging him to leave because he's stirring up the sediment of old memories that he'd prefer to remain where they are. And at the end, it just says a few days later, Bundini Brown fell in his motel room and was found paralyzed from the neck down by a cleaning woman. And then he died. And it's just, it gets me every time I read that paragraph. It just gets me, you know. But it's an amazing, a really amazing piece of sports writing. And then, even though he doesn't speak to Ali in it, because at that point in his life, Ali was essentially silenced by his Parkinson's syndrome, he speaks to his doctor. And that's kind of an interesting, that's a very interesting one as well. You know, it's Ferdy Pacheco, and Ferdy Pacheco essentially says, I walked away because he wouldn't listen anymore. And I could see the cells in his kidneys were deteriorating and that this was causing his brain function to be impaired. And Dave Hannigan wrote a fantastic book about Muhammad Ali's last fight, which a lot of people think was against Larry Holmes, but he fought after the Larry Holmes fight. He fought Trevor Burbick in the Bahamas, and the book is called The Drama in Bahamas, and it's fantastic and it's well worth getting. But when I, you know, you read that and you realize just how badly gone Muhammad Ali was at that point, and just how sinful it was that all these people, some of the people who mentioned this article were still holding onto his tail, just trying to ride the comet for, you know, another 6 months, another year. And that's part of the whole tragedy of Muhammad Ali, really.
Yeah. Because when I read the headline and when I read the first few paragraphs, like the intro has the kind of on-the-nose symbolism you only get away when you're writing nonfiction, in the sense that Ali is giving him a tour, giving Gary Smith a tour of a barn outside his house where he kept all of his photos of him in his prime from the 1960s. And pigeons had nested above and shat all over the photos, basically, you know. And then, so I assumed, I read that, I read Ali and his entourage, I thought, oh, here, we're going to be talking about the people, the Don Kings of this world, who just made money out of Ali and then threw him on the scrap heap. But there, that element is there too. But mostly it's love. Like, I mean, they all...
These people loved him. They loved him deeply. Their world, you know? And you know, I hope people can get their hands on this piece and read it, because it's just, you know, for any student of sports writing in particular, I would say read this piece, because I think I must have read it. I'd say during my career, I read it 5 times a year and always aspired to do work like this, produce work like this. But that's what's clear from the piece. They loved him. He was the center of the world. But eventually nature claims its forfeit. And, you know, and I love the way, like you, Gavin, I love the way the piece starts with this barn, all these photographs, mildew everywhere, pigeons, and it's kind of symbolic. It's kind of representative of Muhammad Ali's body, essentially, that everything breaks down. You know, nature always claims its forfeit. We all return to dust, and there's a real feeling of that, and it's a great way to set up these stories of these people whose lives essentially were, you know, were bolstered by Muhammad Ali's, but then were kind of left bereft. You know, it's like the end of a great love affair. Like, it's like, you know, Elizabeth Taylor after Richard Burton's dead. You know, it's kind of, what they must have felt, you know, we've lost such a huge part of us, such a huge part of our story. Where do you go? And hers is an extraordinary story, because she's working in a high school canteen, you know, and she's sort of dishing out food, and just the ordinariness of the lives afterwards is what stays with you, really.
There is one extraordinary life afterwards, and that's Ferdy Pacheco, and he is my favorite quote in the whole thing. So, like, he was a doctor, he quit medicine, he became, well, all kinds of things, like an NBC commentator, he was a painter, he sold a work for $40,000, he wrote 6 books, 8 screenplays, a play, and then his quote is, "But on my tombstone it will say Muhammad Ali's doctor. It's like being gynecologist to the queen."
Yeah. It's lovely, isn't it? What a quote. Yeah.
And then, like, Gary Smith absolutely sticks the landing, but we will keep that as a surprise for anyone who wants to go and read it. We'll tweet out the link to that article. It's available for free on the Sports Illustrated website. The fourth and final pick is from your namesake and former Sunday Tribune colleague, Paul Kimmage. The Fatal Attraction of Thierry Clavé-Rollat, I think is how we say it. It was published in December 1999 in the Sunday Independent. Can you tell us a little bit about this piece?
Before we do, I want to tell you about my fatal attraction to Paul Kimmage.
Okay.
When I was about 16, I used to collect autographs of sports people, you know, and I was absolutely mad about this. But I was really into cycling at the time, and I jumped over. I was at the Nissan Classic which was on O'Connell Street in Dublin. It was around Dublin city centre, this race. Anyway, the end was on O'Connell Street, and I jumped over a metal barrier and ran up O'Connell Street to get Paul Kimmage's autograph. You know, like, that's, I was, you know, and then somebody in the office, when I was a colleague of his later, somebody told him this story, and I was deeply embarrassed by it. But anyway, by then he was my hero as a sports writer, and I cut this piece out and kept it, you know. But I always did that when I read a piece of sports writing that moved me, or that I said I'd love to be able to do that. I want to do that one day. I want to write like that one day. I cut it out and I put it in a folder, and I have a few folders, but I have one folder that's just full of Paul Kimmage's pieces. And this is the one. I went through it when I knew I was doing this with you today, and this is the one I remembered. I could have picked one of 10, any one of 10 that Paul wrote, but it's this one, The Fatal Attraction of Clave Rolat, that really is my favorite. Mainly because it's just so personal. And Paul's an exceptional writer, and I don't think he ever writes a lazy sentence. You know, it would kill him to write a lazy sentence or even to commit a lazy thought to print. I think it would kill Paul. He writes best, I've always found, when he's invested in a piece, when he's a player in it, and he's very much a player in this piece. Thierry Clavier-Rollat was a French cyclist, a two-time stage winner of the Tour de France, and a great climber, really famous climber. And he was friends with Paul when Paul was cycling. They just hit it off and they were good friends. But they reached this breach when Paul wrote A Rough Ride, his expose of doping in cycling. And everybody turned against Paul in cycling. But very bravely, he went back to the Tour as a reporter in 1990, I think it was. He went to cover it as a journalist. And Clave Rolat cut him dead. And not just that, he launched this vitriolic attack on him that just left Paul with his mouth open. And he'd been accused at that point of, in the parlance, of spitting in the soup. But this attack by Clave Rolat, because they were such good friends, I think really killed him. But the piece really is about the tragedy of, there's tragedy in all of these pieces I've picked. I wonder is there a reason for that? But it just, tragedy just makes great writing. It's just a fact. And this particular piece, Clave Rolat, died by suicide not long after he finished cycling. And this piece really is about Paul's sadness at watching his life unravel. And we talked about it in relation to Ali's entourage, but lots of sports people who achieve great things, it's very, very difficult to transition to an ordinary life. Whatever about people hanging on coattails like Ali's entourage, this is a cyclist. Like, you know, this is a high achiever who, was at the top end of his sport. And then suddenly he finds himself living this ordinary life where he's running this bar in Vizille in France. And he, you know, a series of incidents happens that brings him to the point of not wanting to live anymore. And they are that he's involved in a car crash in which a kid was blinded and he was drunk when he was behind the wheel. So he knew he was probably going to be going to jail. He hired an illegal worker, an illegal immigrant for his bar, you know, to work as a bouncer in his bar, and the bouncer was involved in an incident. The police got involved, so he'd been charged with that. He was running this bar and the business wasn't going well. He's clean, as Paul describes it, cleaning vomit and shit off the floor of the toilets every night. Didn't realize that was actually part of owning a bar, as well as getting up early and going to bed late. And he just paints this picture of this life that's just kind of spinning out in a really sad way. And then he wins a million francs in the lottery. Yeah. He spins the wheel and he wins a million francs. And you think his life, he's going to turn this around. But he doesn't. And that's what's extraordinary about this piece of writing. And it's probably about, I'd say it's about 2,500 words long. And you know at the beginning how he dies by his own hand, and the rest of the piece, there's just an inevitability. We know the end we're coming to, and it's just so sad. And it's such an amazing piece writing, and it's written, you know, Paul just writes with such humanity, you know, and honesty, and it's raw. And there's a moment in it where Paul, not long before he dies, Paul is in the I think it's Vizille, the town where Clavé Rolette had the bar, and Paul is standing outside the bar and he's looking in the window, and he hasn't spoken to him, his old friend, since 1990. So it's probably 18 years. This piece was written in 1990, so it's 18, 19 years. And he's looking through the window of the bar and he sees the shit show that is his old friend's life. And there's two people, I think, drinking in the bar, and Paul thinks he'll go in, and then he doesn't go in. He changes his mind. And, you know, you can see, you can tell from the way it's written that Paul's not altogether happy with this decision that he made, that who knows what might have happened if he'd gone in. He speculates that Clavé Rolette would have probably opened up on him again, and, you know, and nothing would have changed. But there's always that sense of not knowing, you know. What if Clavé Rolette had decided, you know, that... I think at this stage, it was 1999, we'd had the Festina scandal. Nobody was in any doubt whatsoever about the realities of life as in professional cycling. Everybody was at it, everybody was doping. And maybe, you know, maybe it would have been different if he'd called in. But it really is, it's as fine a piece of sports writing as I've ever read, I think.
And the whole story then is ultimately told in the last line. So I'll read the last couple of paragraphs because it's needed for the context of the last line. So Paul is recounting Thierry's final moments. At 3 o'clock, Thierry made his choice. He picked up a pen and listed his instructions. No friends, no flowers, no funeral. His remains were to be cremated. He had one request. His jerseys and trophies were not to be removed from L'Étape. That's the bar. And then the final line, he wanted it to remain exactly as it was, which is, that line is the whole story from, I would suggest, Thierry's point of view and possibly the writer's point of view as well. It's an amazing way to finish it. That's Thierry Clavé Rolette. Again, we'll tweet out the link to that piece. It's absolutely amazing. Paul, we're nearly done. We had a few questions come in from listeners and so on for you. This one is mine. One of the most important pieces the Irish Times has published since maybe the Roy interview in Saipan was published with the headline, Paul Howard, My Top 20 Larry David Moments. Can you tell us what happened with Steve Collins? What happened with Steve Collins?
Yeah, okay. I never actually talked to Steve about this ever.
Okay.
Steve and I fell out a long time ago, you know, over 20 years ago. As I ghostwrote Steve's book, and most ghostwriters eventually fall out with their subjects. It's just the law of these things. But I was quite close to Steve in those, you know, and those were the days of access where, you know, you actually spent time with the sports people you were writing about and got to see them up close and admired them, you know. And I was covering a fight in Verbania in northern Italy. And Steve was fighting against Sumbu Kalembe for the European middleweight title. And Kalembe was old, relatively old. He was well into his 30s, and Steve was kind of reasonably young. This is before he beat Ben and Eubank, that period, like, so he's still quite young. But Steve lost the fight, and it was kind of inexplicable, really, you know. And there were problems with the preparation, which I was privy to. And one of the problems was I was sitting at ringside. I was covering the fight for a few papers. I was freelance at the time, so I was doing it for the Tribune. I think I was doing it the next day for the Irish Times. I was phoning copy back on the telephone to the Irish Times. And I think, as from memory, I had an open phone line because they wanted it round by round. And but it was a very late fight. And then they were going to top it at the end. So I had the phone on. I was reading to the copy taker. Paddy Byrne, who was Steve's corner man, ran over to me and said, Paul, we've no water in the corner. And I kind of look at Paddy as if to say, well, what has that got to do with me? This is the end of round one. And he said, can you go and get some water? And I said, okay. So I put the phone down. I ran up. I knew there was a shop at the back of the, this was kind of like a basketball arena. I knew there was a shop at the back. It was like a little tuck shop. And I walked up to there. I ran up to there and I said, aqua. And that's the, I hadn't much Italian, aqua. And he says, con gas, senza gas. And I just said, yes, I just nodded, right? Because I didn't know what he was saying, with gas or without gas. Anyway, I bring the water back and I gave it to Paddy. And then I went back and sat down. And I continued with the report. And then afterwards, we went to the press conference. And Steve was hinting about being nobbled by the Italians. There was all this thing about going out there that the Italians will do anything underhanded to stop their man losing, you know? The phrase, the popular phrase at the time was that in Italy, you need to knock the guy out to get a draw. And so there was this kind of sense that they would do anything to stop. So Steve was convinced he'd been nobbled. And I remember Tom Crine of The Independent said to him, you know, Steve, you're talking about being noble. What exactly are you talking about? And Steve said, well, I went back to the corner after the second round and the water was fizzy.
Oh, God. And are you at the back trying to tear up receipts subtly?
I don't think I got a receipt, but I was really embarrassed, you know. But I never told Steve. And I ghostwrote Steve's autobiography 2 or 3 years later, you know, and we would have been very close during that period, but I was still too embarrassed to, tell him about it. I mean, I don't think it ruined his life or anything. You know, he went on and he beat Nigel Benn and he beat Chris Eubank. And, but that night in particular, I just know how something like that could mess with somebody's head, with a sportsman's head, to come back to the room and he's got fizzy, to come back to the corner and he's got fizzy water, like, you know. And I always think about that. I remember covering one of Sonia O'Sullivan's races in Paris at the World Championships in 2003. And she lost her shoes a few days before she ran in the 5,000 meters. She left them on the train and got off. And then she sees the shoes on the seat. And she spent 2 days trying to get the shoes back, like ringing every lost and found office in Paris, like essentially trying to get these shoes back. And her sponsor at the time, I think was Nike, sent her a new pair, but she said they were red, and sure, everybody knows you can't run in red shoes. And so that was another reminder for me that they, you know, elite sports people are so sensitive to any tiny little imperfection that might affect their performance. And I suspect that Steve coming back to the corner after the second round and having fizzy water in his mouth may have thrown. Now, it's not my fault in the sense that his corner should have had water in the corner. I mean, that's,
yeah,
seemed pretty basic to me that they should have had water. It certainly wasn't my job to get the water. But yeah, I mean, I think Steve should really have won that fight. And I do often wonder, was it anything to do with what I did?
Another of our listeners, AB, has done some research on you and asks, is it true that you were once covering a school's rugby game and then got sent a solicitor's letter over getting a try scorer's name wrong?
Yeah. I was quite young at the time. I was about, I think I was about 18, and I didn't know anything really about schools rugby. It was new to me, you know. I certainly didn't know why it was taken so seriously. And I remember going to my first match in Skerries. I think it was Skerries Blackrock or someone like that. And, you know, seeing 1500 people at the schools game, you know, and then kind of, you know, being asked for 10 paragraphs, and it's across like six columns of, you know, a broadsheet daily newspaper the next day. And it was at that stage in my career, it was certainly, you know, the biggest story I'd ever been asked to write, like in terms of wordage, you know. I couldn't understand why it was taken so seriously. But I remember being confused by the mass of double barrel names on both teams in this match. There was just names everywhere. I think there may have even been Roman numerals in there. Like, it was just, there were so many names. And I kind of must have lost my concentration or something, but I gave the try to the wrong kid. And I remember being called in by the Indo. I think it was Pat Courtney, actually, was the Indo's, was in the markings in the Indo at the time, you know, and he said, oh, we've had a solicitor's letter. And I was thinking, Jesus, about your match report. And I was thinking, how could I libel somebody in a match report? And he said, oh, you gave the try to the wrong kid. And I said, right. I said, is that serious? And he said to me, well, and this is a great lesson to me, it, you know, for what I would later do for my living, like, you know, he said to me, you have to remember these kids. He said, this kid, he's born, and his dad brings a rugby ball to the maternity hospital and puts it in the basket with him, you know. He said, the kid is brought home. From the time the kid can stand up, the dad is throwing a rugby ball at him, trying to get him to catch the thing, you know. The kid then plays junior rugby with his pals in the park. Then he goes to secondary school. The plan is to get him on the junior cup team. He makes the junior cup team. He's told the most important thing in his entire life then is to make the senior cup team. And he makes the senior cup team. And in his very first match, he scores a try. And you get his fucking name wrong. And actually, I could see it. There's quite a reasonable thing to be upset about when he explained it to me like that, you know? So, but the solicitor's letter, I remember, demanded a retraction, a correction, and an apology. And I was told just to be grateful that they weren't looking for damages as well.
Have you since subtly sneaked the correct name into a Ross book?
I haven't, but I mean, that whole thing about the dad who's ready to defend his sporting son's honor with the solicitor's letter is essentially the dynamic that Ross has with Giles O'Carroll-Kelly, you know? So yeah. I stole that, you know? So that kind of, it's not like it was a wasted lesson on me.
Paul, we have two final questions that we ask everyone. We ask everyone because it gives people the illusion that I've put any kind of structure on the show. Who is the most interesting person you met with work? You don't have to stick this to just sport. If you have since met anyone interesting through subsequent work, which I'm sure you have.
The most interesting, I think Sonia O'Sullivan. I think Sonia O'Sullivan, because I ghost wrote Sonia O'Sullivan's column in the Tribune for 3 or 4 years. So I got to know her quite well, and I covered her career on good days and bad days. And Sonia was fascinating. Nick Badeau telling me once, her husband telling me that Roy Keane visibly shrinks in Sonia's company. And I know exactly what he means by that, like, you know, and that's just one sports person who recognizes something, a quality in another sports person, maybe a quality that even he desired, you know. She really was. She was extraordinary, but then she was also brittle, and you never really knew which version you were going to get, you know. And I covered her career post Atlanta. I remember I covered the World Championships in 97, where, you know, following on from her performance in Atlanta, which was a disaster, and then 97, everybody said after that she was finished. And she came back then, won the double at the World Cross Country in Marrakesh, you know, won a medal at the Europeans in 98. I can't remember anymore. I think it was gold medal. And then, you know, wins the silver medal at the Sydney Olympics, which should have been gold. I mean, you know, I've no qualms about saying, I think Szabo, cheated her out of a gold medal. And I think, you know, subsequently Szabo was implicated to an EPO, was linked to an EPO type drug. And so in my mind, Sonia won the gold medal in Sydney 2000, you know, and then subsequently, you know, again, 2003, the Worlds in Paris. And I mean, she was getting old then, but you kind of never knew if Sonia was going to win a medal or be lapped. Like, it was,
yeah,
even if you were close to her, it was, I mentioned the shoes there, you know, there was just, it was like a hair trigger or something, like anything could, but she was fascinating. Like, and I suppose Sonia and Roy Keane, that's the thing. It's the same thing for me with the two of them. I spent so much of my career as a sports writer trying to figure out what was going on in their heads, because they were the two most fascinating.
Are you still interested in Roy Keane? Because now he's just a like really loudmouth pundit on TV who doesn't really have a whole lot, in my opinion anyway, doesn't have a whole lot interesting to say. And certainly when I watch him as a pundit, I certainly don't learn anything more about what I just watched. I might learn a bit more about Keane himself.
Yeah, I mean, I've been disappointed by him in the last 10 years, you know, but I don't think he was ever really going to make it as a manager, because I don't think he has the qualities that make a good manager. I think he's too unforgiving of weakness in others. I don't think he understands, I was going to say the modern footballer, but it's actually, I'm not sure he understands people in their teens and their 20s. Like, they're different to him. I don't think he gets, and it's actually evident in a lot of his punditry as well, where he talks about the way Brian Clough used to motivate them or Alex Ferguson used to motivate them. That doesn't work anymore. You know, it's become football. It's football management is, it's so much more nuanced now. You know, you're dealing with complex personalities, you know, and I mean, when you see somebody like Jose Mourinho, who doesn't take shit from anyone, and he's forced to agree to this ridiculous ridiculous arrangement with Paul Pogba, where Pogba has this Rolls Royce that he wants to drive home from matches, and Mourinho says, no, you have to get on the bus. And they're negotiating how far from the stadium he can get off the bus and get into this Rolls Royce that his driver is following the team bus in. And you think, of course Roy Keane would tell Paul Pogba to fuck off, but that might not necessarily be the best thing for the team or the club. It might be in Pogba's case that it happens, but there are all different types of players and personalities, and they all need different things. And I don't think he has the subtlety of personality to give players those things. And as a pundit, I think he's terrible, and he's become this caricature. And Roy Keane was never a caricature. I remember Roy Keane saying in interviews, the ultimate hell for him would be to become a pundit. And he's kind of living that hell, and he doesn't look like he enjoys it. To me, he doesn't look like he even likes football. I mean, he said, Liam Brady made that very point about him, really pertinent point. He said, Roy Keane doesn't seem to like anybody in football. He doesn't have any of his former teammates' phone numbers. He wears it as a badge of pride that he's not friends with anybody he played football with. He's not friends with anyone in the game. He hates modern football. So why is he still hanging around and making his living from it? You know, it can't be because he needs the money. And he never provides any insights for me. I mean, Carragher and Gary Neville have just, you know, taken punditry to a whole other level, you know, and I could listen to the two of them all night long. But Roy Keane just doesn't really have anything interesting to say about the game. And I can't, you know, that's shocking to hear myself say that, but he just doesn't.
Mm. And our final question, Paul, is the most interesting place you've been with work?
Oh, I think Iran. I think Iran for the World Cup playoff in 2001. And it was, you know, there are very few culture shocks left in the world, you know, when you travel. I mean, we're all so used to traveling now, you know. Well, we were before COVID. It's not a big deal to travel. We don't send postcards anymore when we go away, because it's just such a normal thing to go away. So there's very few culture shocks left in the world, but Iran was a real culture shock. And I think what was interesting about that trip, as well as the fact that it was a World Cup qualifier, it was the time the match was played. It was November 2001. And it's 8 weeks, 10 weeks after 9/11. And we're going to the Middle East for a football match. And, you know, America is still engaged in a war in nearby Afghanistan, you know, and it's we went there just feeling tense, you know. I remember just not being able to sleep for about a week before we went. It was just so tense. And then we were totally disarmed by the reaction of the Iranian people. It was like we expected hostility, and it was just the opposite, like, you know. I remember just walking around the street and they're just shouting, "Raikin, Raikin," at us, like, "Raikin." They said, "Raikin, Raikin." And I remember I was out with Dion Fanning and John O'Brien, a few journalists one night. We went into this marketplace and John was buying some fruit, and he bought apples and oranges or something like that. And the owner of the shop pulled back this curtain, and his family were all sitting around a table eating dinner. And he told us to sit at the table, and we had dinner with this family. Like, you know, it was extraordinary. And I remember the stadium that night, because the football starts and it all changes. And that's when we suddenly felt like foreigners in a hostile land for the length of the match and about an hour and a half afterwards. But the call to prayer happened in the stadium just before the kickoff. We were sitting in our seats and this noise starts, you know, which to our ears sounds like, it's everybody in the stadium except the Irish people in the stadium kind of know the words, you know. It's kind of like being at a wedding in Donegal and everybody starts line dancing and you're the only one who doesn't know how to line dance, right? I remember Paul Hyland from the Herald just turned to me and just looked at me, and there was this look passed between us, and it just said, you know, we are very, very far from home tonight. Like, you know, we are very far from home. And Ireland lost the match, but won over two legs. And the Iranian fans lit fires in the stadium, right? There was fires because there's no seats, like, so it's not a kind of Bradford's 1985 situation where the stadium could go up in flames. It's just terraces everywhere. And they lit these fires on the terraces. This fire's burning, and you sense that the fans are really upset. They thought they were going to win and go to the World Cup. And we were told to stay in the stadium for an hour, 2 hours after the final whistle. We had work to do, so we did all that. And then we were driven straight to the airport. And I remember for about 2 miles outside the stadium, there was just nothing but broken glass everywhere. That there was a riot and they smashed the windows of pretty much every car within walking distance of the stadium. And we drove over this broken glass, but the streets had been cleared then, like the riot police had moved in and just cleared this obstruction. And then everybody went back to their daily lives, you know. But it was amazing. I don't think I was ever anywhere where I felt that sort of sense of exhilaration just from where I was rather than the sport I was watching.
Paul, we're out of time. Thanks so much.
Pleasure, Gavin. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much to Paul. I should have said it earlier, but Paul has a couple of books out at the moment. Braywatch is the latest in the Ross Carl Kelly series. And he also out at the moment is the second in the series of children's books he is writing with Gordon Darcy. It's called Gordon's Game, Blue Thunder. Both are published by Penguin Sandycove, the artist formerly known as Penguin Ireland. That is it for this week. We hope you enjoyed the show, and thank you as ever for your support of us. We couldn't do it without you, so we are going to be back next week with another great guest. But until then, take it easy.